Happy Bitcoin Sunday, freaks. It's your boy Odell here for another Citadel Dispatch. I am very excited for this conversation. We got Clark Moody in the house. Before we get there, just a huge shout out, as always, to the ride or die freaks who continue to support the show and keep it ad-free, sponsor-free, and purely focused on actionable discussion. The easiest way to support the show is through podcasting 2.0 apps. Fountain Podcasts and Breeze Wallet are my favorite. You simply load up your app with some sats, with some Bitcoin. Choose how many sats per minute are you think this content is worth to you. And then from there, it'll just stream automatically to my node. Through Podcasting 2.0, you can also do something called Boostagrams. That's when you send a specific amount of sats to support the show, and you can include a message with that. It's pretty cool. You end up with this comment system that has value attached to it that is readable on all Podcasting 2.0 apps. As always, the top four boostograms from the previous episode will be read on air. We have Chad Farrow, who gave 33,000 sats, 33,333 sats, and provided no message. I appreciate you, Chad. We have Eric Rome, who provided 25,000 sats to support the show. He said, thank you to Slim for providing sound information relating to cattle deaths. So useful. I'm now looking into the beef initiative. We have poor Ben Gunn, who provided 5,000 sats without a message. Shout out to Ben. Your support means a lot to me. I have a lot of respect for that dude. Great dude. And we have Nomad Joe with 3,000 sats saying, thanks for Bitcoin Thursday and interviewing Texas Slim. There's a bunch of other boostograms here. At lower amounts, you can view them in your favorite podcasting 2.0 app at your leisure. I also want to say that if you cannot part with sats currently, you can also support the show by simply searching Citadel Dispatch in your favorite podcasting app and clicking the subscribe button, potentially leaving a good review. It really does help. So thank you all. Also, while we're here, a reminder that you can join the live chat both via Twitch. That's twitch.tv/CitadelDispatch or via our Matrix chat. Our Matrix chat is just constant, awesome discussion all throughout the week. You can get the link to that at CitadelDispatch.com. So with all that said, we do have a very tight time window here. Clark is simply passing through and has dedicated some time. We're going to be about 45 minutes here to chat with us all, and very grateful for that. How's it going, Clark?
It is fantastic to be here on Citadel Dispatch.
Welcome to the new studio. What do you think? There we go.
It's amazing. Got my LaCroix. Got the hospitality going. It's great. The studio is excellent. It's quiet. Beautiful.
The soundproofing's insane.
Soundproofing's wonderful. I'm actually jealous.
It makes you
a lot jealous.
I feel like you can hear your thoughts in your head way more.
Yeah.
It gets stuck.
For better or for worse, you know.
So, Clark, I think you're most famous for your dashboard, the Clark Moody dashboard. What was the thought process behind releasing that in the first place?
If you'll remember back to the Fork Wars, we had lots of stats people were looking at. User agents people were typing in for their UASF nodes, block signaling from the miners, all that sort of stuff going on. And you were looking at four or five different websites at a time,
right,
just to see one number. So I'm going to, what was it? Fork.lol or whatever,
right,
like old school, all these things. And you're looking for one number. Okay. What's the percentage of nodes here? What's the percentage of signaling there? And I was thinking, well, it would be really nice to have all those numbers in one place with no frills. Just the numbers, just a big wall of numbers. And so that was the idea. I don't want to have to go to all these different sites.
Like six different tabs open.
Yeah, all these tabs, you know. I don't want to have to go all those different sites. I just want it all in one place.
Super clean, completely donation-based, proud supporter of your dashboard. What is the website? Is it clarkmoody.com?
bitcoin.clarkmoody.com/dashboard.
I just put CL in my browser now and just automatically just fills it out.
Sure, if you just search for Clark Moody dashboard.
Awesome. I also just wanted to do a quick shout out to you. Your donation page is one of the cleanest donation pages in the space. I feel like you don't get enough credit for it.
The finest donation experience in Bitcoin.
Anyway, freaks, if you appreciate his dashboard, consider going and supporting it. So Clark, I mean, we're all yours today. What do you want to talk about? What gets you excited when you think about Bitcoin? You've been in the space for, I think, longer than I have.
Yeah. So, you know, stuff happening on the privacy front is really exciting. First of all, you know, Fedimint, Minimint stuff.
What do you think about that? Am I right to be excited about that? Cause I've been getting a lot of shit. Cause I've been hyping it a bit.
Bullish on it since day one. I read the Skrit Cash paper from the smuggler and the Prague guys, and I was looking at Skrit Cash on like how do we implement this, how do we make it happen, and then Sirion comes out of nowhere at HTTP last year, drops a prototype,
right?
And it's just, you know, the federated Chaumian Mint is the way you get amazing privacy. The federated spin on it gives you a little bit less custody risk. And so it's,
and then the cool part to me is, I mean, that's all well and good, but the cool part to me is this idea of the Lightning gateway, so you can pay and receive from basically any Bitcoin wallet.
Yeah, Lightning interop I think is the magic,
because if you look at something that's federated, I mean, it doesn't have Chaumian eCash, but it's federated like Liquid, and just no one uses it,
right?
I gotta imagine part of the reason is the friction moving between the federation and
and the weight of, you don't need a blockchain for eCash,
right?
And so that's the whole that's part of the magic there, is it's just these instant transfers of these eCash tokens. You don't need a blockchain. Interop with Lightning means that you can go in and out very fast. So if you have concerns about solvency of the mint or inflation or whatever, you can get your funds out at the speed of the Lightning network,
right?
And so there might be a lot of people that dip in a little bit, come back out, dip in, and as long as that mint is keeping up that trust of, hey, any of your Lightning withdrawals that are going out, they never get paused, so you get more trust in the mint.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but one of the cool parts of how they have it currently set up, or like the plan in place, is that essentially anyone who's a part of the mint, not just the federation members, can be running these Lightning gateways. So you could actually have multiple Lightning gateways, and there's almost a free market competition among the Lightning gateways of a specific federation.
Right. There's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Yeah. But yeah, I find that very promising. What else? What else you got for us?
Well, I've been thinking about Bitcoin in space.
Yeah.
Again. So I wrote one article called Bitcoin and the Interplanetary Frontier back in 2017. And I'm a lot faster at writing code than I am at writing prose, so I haven't written the follow-up yet. But, you know, I thought that we're hunkered down in the Citadel. You know, the world's going crazy out there.
Right.
The bear market's on. We've battened down the hatches, and we're in build mode. And we could go Doomer Pod, but I was thinking we look outward.
There's a lot of Doomer Pods out there.
We look forward. Something new, you know, some sort of evergreen content for the next bull market.
So like the two space Bitcoin space pros, I guess, in the space are you in the space, are you and Deruv from Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
Deruv is pretty sure that people in space are going to be using shitcoins. Where do you fall on that? Are Martians going to be using shitcoins, or are they going to be using Bitcoin?
So this is the big question for me. I don't think you can go interstellar with Bitcoin.
Okay.
Citadel Proxima, right, in the Alpha Centauri system is 4 light years from Earth, okay? So I don't know if you can have 10-minute block times and transfer that much data 4 light years for the plebs over there on Proxima.
The trust model breaks down.
The trust model breaks down. Then you back it up a little bit, and you're getting into one of these ships to go to another star. All right.
Okay.
You're setting out with like 1,000 people in this generation ship. It's going to take you 5,000.
What year is this?
I don't know. 2025, 2026. No. Soon though. And, we need to get off this planet. Anyway,
you jump on the ship
and the big question to me is, do you hard fork Bitcoin and keep and take the UTXO set with you, do you try to launch something new? Because then the mining comes into play, and you know the premise of Bitcoin, right?
Right.
Internet cash without a trusted third party.
Right.
In a space exploration setting, you've got a really closed ecosystem. Like one ship is the entire universe for these 100 people.
That's their economy.
That's their whole economy, all this sort of stuff.
There might be some connection back. They might still have financial obligations back home or something.
Right. But if, yeah. But you got to, you kind of sell all your property before you, you know, head on a ship to another star.
You're not coming you're back. Not it's back. A one-way trip.
Yeah, your great-grandchildren are not coming back. So it'd be awesome to have this sound money to kick off the new human civilization. It'd be cool if you could do it off of a few UTXOs from the original Bitcoin chain and carry that through. You have to fork, because if you separated the chains for like 1,000 years and then they came back together, one would wipe out the other and you'd lose like 1,000 years worth of chain. Okay, so you don't want to do that. You got to have some sort of separation, some sort of fork. But the question is, do you bootstrap it off of UTXOs or do you try to launch something new, maybe even when you get there? So I don't know. That's pretty far out. That's pretty cosmic. All right.
Well, you wanted to get cosmic. Usually we talk about more like hands-on stuff, but we're all yours here. So just grateful to have you in the studio.
Yeah. But if you roll it back, like Mars, right? Moon is perfectly fine. So the moon is, you know, 1.5 light seconds away. You could potentially have a video call with somebody on the moon.
Okay.
Mars is 3 to 22 minutes away, light time. So you need block confirmations. There's a couple more block confirmations to use Bitcoin on Mars. But you could use Lightning Network locally on Mars.
And then settle.
And if you had to,
settle on the main chain.
That's right. And so it's just 2 blocks extra confirmation time that you need. Maybe 4, because you need there and back round.
But that's doable.
That's doable.
So the Martians aren't going to be using shitcoins.
I don't think they have to. No. What I've also been thinking about is, like, you've got this period where from Mars or from the Earth, it's behind the sun in certain parts of the orbit, right? So it's like, you can't communicate with it because it's in this solar blackout zone, right? So of course you need...
You've really thought about this.
Yeah, you need like comm satellite, you know, relay stations in different orbits to relay the information around the sun, so you can still have this sort of back and forth, you know, communication between the split civilizations of Earth or of humanity, right? Which also, I think, partly alleviates Dhruv's concern that you need hash power in both locations. The center of hash concept that he introduced,
right,
makes it to where the Earth-based miners could reject all the transactions from Mars if there's some sort of conflict, right?
Right.
But if you can relay the data, then some miner will mine the blocks, because how can you tell this one comes from Mars? And you just put a fee on it and they respond to incentives.
Right.
So it's kind of the ultimate...
They don't mine it, you keep increasing the fee or whatever till they mine it, till right. Someone mines it.
Right. You spend all day waiting for, you know, did it come in a block, you know? Using the dashboard would probably be pretty slow.
But have you looked into, are there massive energy resources on Mars? I just kind of feel like, I assume there are.
I don't actually know. I haven't looked into the energy there. It's got less solar, so it's farther away.
Right.
There's less atmosphere, so you couldn't do as much wind, but I'm sure they'll bring nuclear generators with them.
Right.
In the colonies.
I mean, you can just do that wherever.
And you can do that wherever. That's right. Yeah.
So they won't have there's no cost advantage if it's nuclear.
Oh, the real thing is chip fab, you know. Can you get...
You'd have to bring all the chips up with you, basically.
Yeah. You know, like ASIC fabs are essentially one of the few, like, pinnacles of human, like, capitalistic economies. Like, there's so much that goes into building a chip fab. So much supply chain and so much, you know, high technology and smart people and all sorts of stuff, that getting that getting a chip fab up and running on Mars would take a long, long, long time.
And it's hard enough to just get the chip fabs in America.
It's hard enough to get them here, you know, where we need them. Yeah. And they're not under the control of foreign powers that are potentially hostile to the U.S. So
have you ever read or watched Expanse?
I read the first book.
What did you think of it?
It was cool. I like how they had a colony in the asteroid belt. That was pretty sweet.
Well, so that's how, so the way it works in Expanse is there's the Earth civilization and then there's the Mars civilization, and they're basically equivalent in power. They work together to a degree, but they're frenemies. And then there's like the belters that have only grown up in the asteroid belt on right. like space stations and stuff.
They're starting to diverge from humanity because they're low gravity and stuff like that.
But like as a sci-fi nerd, one of the things, I mean, Expanse is really cool because they like try and make it as connected to physics and realistic as possible. As someone who's doesn't really know any of that shit, pretty sure. But most of all the sci-fi books always just throw out the money question. They just say like credits, right? Right. And they never tell you like how the money works or how that communication goes, how that consensus happens.
Right.
It's just they're using fucking credits.
Yeah. There was one set of books that I read that were more of like an ANCAP author, the Aristillus series. Pretty low quality books, but he did think about a lot of this stuff in the context of a lunar colony. So it's kind of like an anarcho-capitalist lunar society in
it's the, like seasteading on the moon,
right? In the vein of the Earth as a harsh mistress, you know, that sort of. Usually sci-fi ignores the money question, but even in, you know, post scarcity, post money, like Star Trek, there's still conflict. There's still scarcity. Yeah, so it's kind of like disingenuous, right?
So, I mean, let's just bring this back to Earth a little bit. I mean, these types of questions, I mean, we're extrapolating them or you're extrapolating them for space. But this goes hand in hand with the idea of, okay, someone's in China and someone's in the United States. How can they use Bitcoin in a trust minimized way? Right, which is reducing latency in terms of block times, like in actual block propagation, not block times, making sure that data actually hits all the participants in a relatively quick amount of time, keeping that data overhead as low as possible. Can you explain to the freaks, you know, why that is necessary?
Yeah, because if the longer it takes to learn about a block, the less of an advantage any miner has. So you have this median 10-minute block time. And if it takes 30 seconds to propagate the block to the miner, they've just lost 5% of the time. So they'll probably lose 5% of their revenue. They'll produce more orphans. You know, in case a block was found in that little bit of time, they'll now be one block behind and they will have wasted that right. time.
And in practice, it's so the miner who mines it has an advantage in that situation. Mm-hmm. And in practice, it leads to miner centralization rather than what we want, which is as much mining distributed as possible and in many hands as possible.
Yeah. Even like a block withholding attack is where you find a block and you mine a little bit on it to try to find another one before you
don't release, broadcast it right away.
Yeah. You release both of them to the network at the same time.
Right. And this is an attack that basically you need to have a large amount of hash under single control to try and pull off that attack.
Right. And the pools may be doing it. You know, maybe the bad actor pools are doing it. And it may not be an attack, depending on how
it's
you look
at it. I mean, it's a greedy, it's maybe just a normal incentive play, right?
Right.
Because they can lose if they play that game and someone else comes out with a block and it propagates really quickly, then they can just get fucked and they can lose out on the first block.
So they're taking a little bit of risk.
Which is why the whole system's propagation needs to be
right
as fast as possible,
right,
low latency as possible to basically incentivize quote-unquote good behavior.
And that's what the fiber network is all about.
Right.
It's just communicating all the transactions ahead of time and just the block
the header. The thing Corallo created.
Right.
And it's spelled FIBRE, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
Fast internet block relay.
Basically, it's miners are connected without, they're not actually propagating it through the the normal gossip P2P network or whatever of Bitcoin,
right? Special connections.
Just separate.
Special connections and then way more data. So right. that every miner has hopefully all of the transactions in the block prior to just receiving the header from the found block. So that's only 80 bytes that has to go over the internet. And then like the list of transactions, just the TXIDs, not the full transaction data.
Right.
So you can relay the found block very, very, in a very lightweight way. And that's kind of the best you can do as far as, you know.
But that's like that's opt-in on a miner basis if they want to use it or not.
But I'm sure there's a financial advantage to doing it.
Otherwise
you're just getting full blocks, you know, getting whole blocks from the network.
Yeah, unless you're like a very large miner and you're trying to basically do block withholding attacks.
Right.
And I guess you read from fiber, but you don't broadcast on it or something like that, right?
I guess you could, but I don't know.
But I guess like we can't really extrapolate something like fiber for space travel because there's a physics limitation. It's not like humans can, because I mean, besides money, there's a massive incentive for humans to try and make communication with the outer planets as easy as possible.
Right.
But there's a physics limitation there, right? Like you can only make it
speed of light.
We can't go past the speed of light, right?
Not yet.
Are we going to ever be able to?
I don't know.
You heard it here first, guys. Clark is bullish on faster than speed of light communication.
All you CERN physicists who are listening in, hit us up in the comments.
I just want to say that I'm proud that you don't think the Martians are going to be using shitcoins, because I was pretty sure they weren't going to be using shitcoins.
You just need a couple block confirmations. But I think that, you know, we talk about communication. So this really incentivizes people to set up these comm relay systems and sell bandwidth. Because if it's all just one dish and you just knock out that dish, then Mars is shut down, right? So it's going to take lots of entrepreneurs to set up.
Do you think Mars will be settled? It's a really great Bitcoin question. Do you think Mars will be settled by governments, or will it be privately led?
Probably private. The cost to governments when they're all bankrupt at this point would be way too high, and it just couldn't be done politically.
Do you think it'll be a single corporation that controls Mars, or do you think it'll be multiple corporations?
I think it'll be independent groups of Bitcoiners.
Like, what are the chances?
Chartering rockets.
I mean, I disagree with Daru's premise that like Martians have to use shitcoins and like they're incentivized to use shitcoins. Right. But I wouldn't disagree with, this is not his premise, but I wouldn't disagree with the idea that shitcoiners tend to ruin all the good things. So I would like, what are the chances that the first successful colony is like led by one of these shitcoiners that has a shit ton of Bitcoin, just funds it all himself?
If they're funding it with Bitcoin, you know, I don't know.
That's like the biggest part of the shitcoin scam, right? Is that they all hold huge back, like they shitcoin to have Bitcoin.
Right.
Like I'm thinking like the EOS guys like have like 140,000 Bitcoin or something like that.
Right.
Like they could just make it EOS Planet, or I'm not even going to say his name, but the guy who like dresses in Prada all the time or something, right? Like it's his planet, Mars Corp.
Well, when the scam collapses and the whole colony like dries up and all the people die, then maybe there will be some repercussions, you know?
We have Winsome Hacks in the comments saying you can bet some scammers already cooking up a narrative for interplanetary DeFi.
Wasn't there a Mars coin at some point?
Probably. There was a Luna coin, right? That fucking collapsed.
So you could make an argument for an interplanetary settlement coin that has really long block times, like 1 day or 1 week or 1 year long block intervals or something. And it's potentially tied to the Bitcoin chain.
And how would you tie it to the Bitcoin chain?
You would say to mine this thing, you have to put the hash of a Bitcoin block that's, you know, 100,000 higher than the previous block in our chain. You have to put the Bitcoin hash in it. And so you have to validate both chains to do it. Or you just do enough proof of work that it takes a year to find a block or whatever. And then you have this like really long
to connect everything, and then each economy has its own local whatever.
Right. Yeah, the center of hash, right, could be very, very large, or the total hash horizon or whatever could be very large because block propagation, the latency wouldn't be as high of a fraction of the block time. So, you know, it's like 10 minute blocks, you can only go about a light minute out or something. So like maybe to Mars or whatever. If you're mining.
Well, I have a feeling that I'm not going to be alive for these hash wars, but I think my grandkids are going to have a really fucking fun time with it. It should be I love all the adversarial stuff that happens in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Incentivize people to follow the rules.
Like, I think some people, like, I'm glad the fork wars happened. Are you glad the fork wars happened?
Yes.
And I'm glad I got to live through them. I'm glad I got to be heavily attentive and involved during them.
Yeah.
It was a very special moment in Bitcoin history. Very exciting.
Very exciting. It was essential, though, to allow people to make changes and see what happens, right? They got to find out.
Exactly. Look around and find out.
That's right. And so they found out, and people, if they dumped all their Bitcoin for the other chains, they just got hosed.
Absolutely wrecked.
Absolutely wrecked. So, you know, and it also, it's a pressure release valve, right? Oh, we can't change Bitcoin, so we just got to go do something else. We can't, you know, we're not going to steer this ship.
Right.
It's no stopping this train, you know?
Do you think there's going to be, so I feel like some people took the wrong thing from the fork wars, and that being, I guess this is a leading question. Do you think there'll be successful hard forks in Bitcoin in the future?
I think unless we find a way around it, we have to hard fork at least once.
So the 2140 thing.
Because of the timestamp.
Yeah, but is that 2140? Am I, it makes it my years? It's in a while.
2106.
2106?
Yeah. Your 2106 problem.
It's like the Unix time code something.
We run out of seconds on an unsigned 32-bit integer. So once you do that, you go back to 1970 and the network would halt.
But that's not what I mean. I mean, so obviously there's going to be a lot of support for doing something like that because we have no choice.
Yeah, no choice. Yeah.
And, you know, there'll be years of discussion, maybe decades of discussion on how to do that. So part of my Bitcoin zen in holding Bitcoin long term is that I believe that the fork wars showed us that Bitcoin is extremely hard to change by default. And that's one of the key value props of Bitcoin. And to change it significantly, particularly to have a hard fork, you need to basically have this groundswell of support for it. And it's really hard to measure. You can't really measure it until after you fork. So it's like a very rough consensus type of situation. But ultimately, the way I look at it is the value of Bitcoin is abstractly in the actual UTXO set, in the actual ledger of transactions. This is a basic living document, living ledger of everyone's wealth over time. Mm-hmm. That's immutable. So if there was, for some reason, some kind of thing that we needed to, if there was some reason we needed to change Bitcoin and add something to Bitcoin or adopt some kind of new technology that doesn't exist today, if we hit a point where like there was a lot of pain, there was a lot of push, there was a lot of support, consensus around changing Bitcoin to that thing, there would be a hard fork, and that potentially that hard fork could become the dominant chain.
Right.
And if you were holding Bitcoin, you could just go into a coma. You can go to sleep and just not even pay attention to it. You have on both chains anyway.
Right.
But ultimately, whichever one the market values as the sounder money is the one that succeeds. I mean, because the thing is, like, Bcash, And then later SV, like they had just really shitty developers running it. There was no real momentum or motivation to change to it. Like I think it's called, like people should be careful about extrapolating too much from that situation. Is there not, could there not be a situation where there was basically, first of all, anyone can fork at any time. No one can stop them. That's part of Bitcoin, right? Do you think there could ever be a situation where there was a fork that's not the Unix time related that was successful?
Well, so just one note about Bcash, right? It required a second hard fork almost immediately because planning for a hard fork is really hard. And you mentioned the quality of developers. There just wasn't enough,
they had the worst
developer
worst.
Time on it to say, okay, hey, we're actually introducing a reason for another hard fork within weeks.
Right.
And so you don't want that first hard fork followed by a second emergency hard fork, because then you just lose all credibility about everything.
Right.
Right. So you want it planned ahead. And I think if there's a Bitcoin hard fork with strong consensus, it will probably have a five or 10 year.
It won't be like an impulse thing.
It'll be like, hey, everybody remember in 10 years, we're forking, get ready. 10 years, make sure your stuff is ready, right? People will still wait till the last minute, but
everyone,
it'll have this big, long advanced on it, this big, long advanced runway on it. There's maybe something with quantum attack. If a quantum attack becomes apparent, maybe, but I don't know how you could.
But there's like a bunch of things that we can't even conceptualize, right?
Sure, right.
That's why I thought about it, because we were talking about space.
Right.
Like, we have no fucking idea what's going to happen in space.
However, mathematics, right, is at least a universal language. So if you can prove something mathematically, then maybe that proof would hold everywhere in the universe. So I don't know.
Well, like one of the things I took away from Bcash was, so anyone can fork.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other takeaway is that only one fork will be successful.
Right.
So whichever chain wins, the other one's going to trend to zero is my thesis.
Right.
And so the question is, will there ever be one that is not the, because presumably with the Unix thing, the time code thing, there'll be a hard fork, but no one will keep the chances that someone tries to keep the original chain alive is probably very minimal, just because why would you do that? You still have a ticking time bomb on the back end. So I would almost say that that's probably not even relevant to this discussion for that reason.
Well, right? I think that the hard fork, does it preserve the ASIC compatibility with the existing
of course.
Install base,
yeah.
Or does it like,
well, if you take that out, then then you're a whole different ball game, right?
Right. Okay. So it's ASIC compatible. The miners,
it's still SHA-256. We're still using that, whatever year this is.
The miners still have that incentive to be on the winning chain because the other one's going to zero. They have to choose.
Right. Like I've said many times with Ethereum and the proof of stake thing, like if you fork out the miners have every incentive to just continue on the original chain. There's they have absolutely nothing to lose,
right?
Because they can't mine the new chain.
Now their hardware is all worthless.
Yeah.
Maybe ETC will come back. The ETC people are gonna.
I don't think so. I think if they ever actually successfully do an ETH fork to proof of stake, which is still yet to be seen, if that actually happens
soon,
2 weeks. I think the miners just continue the original chain. I think they just fork out the difficulty bomb or whatever, and then they just continue because they have absolutely nothing to lose. I think I said I like the adversarial stuff when it happens on Bitcoin. I like it even more when it happens on shitcoins because it doesn't affect my money.
Right.
So I think that could be like the new fork war learning experience for like the new class without it affecting me at all, which could be good.
Yeah, there's the hashtag change the code crowd that wants to just switch. Devs can just switch to proof of stake. Come on, guys, this is not hard.
Takes a $5 million donation to the scam that is Greenpeace, and you can hashtag change the code.
I think that there will be a proof of stake fork at some point to try to be compliance friendly, ESG friendly, whatever. I think someone
Bitcoin.
Yeah, someone will try it.
I hope so. Then you just get a free dividend.
Right.
Just sell our proof of stake token and get more Bitcoin with it.
If it even has appreciable value. Like Bcash, you know, did have a sizable value relative to the main chain for a while before it just petered off to almost nothing.
Well, that's why we need to get the ESG funds into Bitcoin first, then have the proof of stake fork.
Look, guys, we're ESG friendly.
And then they'll all bag hold the proof of stake fork.
Then we
dump onto them.
Yeah. The ultimate dump is Bitcoiners dumping on the ESG.
It'd be nice to get another 30% dividend on Bitcoin.
ESG dividend. Someone will hard fork the supply cap.
Eventually, at some point.
At some point, someone will say, all right, after the next halving, annual monetary inflation goes to 0.7% or something like that. Harder than gold and not that much new supply coming online. So someone will say, hey, we kind of need either a constant number or a constant percentage or something growth because, you know, inflation people never stop, right?
Right.
We got to have inflation. So someone will hard fork
and also like the transaction fee FUD, which we're already seeing. Every bear market, you hear the fee FUD, right?
It's the death spiral, see?
Yeah.
The fees drop off, the price drops, and the hash rate goes too big, and the chain dies. That's...
Yeah, I mean, someone will do it at some point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, death spiral FUD will never die. Transaction fee FUD, energy FUD.
It'll probably be like at a time of low fee environment while Bitcoin's in a bear cycle, right?
It will have crashed from like 30 million a coin down to like 2 million a coin. And people will say it's going to die.
See, I love this shit. You wanted to go cosmic, but I like controversial. Controversial stuff is more exciting. We have Citrinity in the comments. He goes, do you think, ride or die freak Citrinity, shout out to you. He goes, do you think Bitcoin is fungible? Do you have any concerns with Bitcoin's current fungibility? Do you think we should be pushing for things like cross-input signature aggregation?
I mean, the people who proposed Schnorr said that cross-input is one of the goals here, and
they're
working on it. Of course, I think we need it because it makes it makes coin joins more economically advantageous than single spends. Fungibility, you know, there's a lot of voodoo chain analysis stuff, and third parties can make your life, you know, a lot more tough than self custody of coins.
Right.
So, I think a lot of people need to get burned a little harder on that before they take it seriously. But as long as you're doing self-custody, it gets way harder to have the KYC encroachment matter as much.
The KYC encroachment's insane, though.
It's absolutely insane. Yeah.
I mean, like if I've been around the block for a decent amount of time.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think you've been around long. I mean, like 2016, pre 2016, none of these services had KYC. Pretty much none of them had KYC.
Right.
Maybe Coinbase had like some light KYC. But pretty much none of the services that were operating in and around Bitcoin had, definitely not by far this stringent of KYC, but pretty much most of them had no KYC. And then like in a matter of 2 years, it was like the frog boiling,
yep.
Right? And now it's just the standard. Like if you're a newcomer coming into the space, you just assume that's how it's always been.
Right.
Like KYC is, I still think the majority of state attacks have not happened yet, but KYC is a massive attack on Bitcoin that just has been very successful. Like there hasn't really been much pushback or.
It's because we haven't seen the crackdown.
Do you think you mentioned, so Trinity mentioned cross-input signature aggregation, but you mentioned the value of cross-input signature aggregation, which is that CoinJoin are more affordable. They're cheaper than a regular transaction.
Right.
They're not cheaper than if you're just holding in a custodial wallet.
No.
And I think there's something to be said there because... like I love our open source contributors. I love our developers. I love everyone who works on Bitcoin. But there's a tendency in Bitcoin to focus on the code, focus on the actual internal things of Bitcoin rather than external pressures. And one of the things I noticed over the last 2 years, and I mean, hopefully this will be a massive learning lesson if BlockFi does completely blow up. But we already know Celsius is blown up. We know Voyager's basically insolvent. Probably Nexo, all of these different lending, centralized lending platforms. But when you talk about incentives, it's like, okay, well, even in cross-input signature aggregation, like it'll be way less affordable than to just give it to a custodian and get your 6% yield or whatever.
Yeah, that 6% is sure worth it at this point, isn't it?
But I'm saying like that's what competing with that, right?
Right.
All of these Bitcoin privacy sovereign stuff are competing with the incentives of the custodial regulated system, no?
Well, I'll tell you what, if they get Lightning enabled for point of sale stuff, I mean, that's a game changer because you can spend sats.
I got a lot of shit for saying that.
You can spend sats.
I think Mahler's announcement this year at the Bitcoin conference was way bigger than the last year one, because I think it's really cool that a Latin American country is making Bitcoin legal tender, but there's 6 million people there. They have a tiny GDP. If half of retail merchants in America are accepting Lightning payments, complete game changer.
If I could buy my briefcase of LaCroix at Walmart with sats,
and the other thing
nobody
is,
knows that I got it, you know?
There's a lot of nuance about Lightning privacy, but all else equal, you know, they probably will not know what UTXO funded that transaction.
Exactly.
So there's no history there. It's actually like a cash transaction.
Exactly.
The issue, people say to me, like, what is the difference between this and BitPay? I mean, you remember like 2013, 2014, where it was like BitPay, we just got another retailer after another retailer over and over again. Well, the difference is that was all on chain. So there was this whole history that was attached with every transaction.
Right.
And I mean, I know you're a very privacy focused guy. Me personally, when I spend Bitcoin on chain, there's a massive mental burden. Who am I paying? What is the history on that UTXO? What am I exposing? Am I going to regret this transaction in 6 years? You don't have that with Lightning.
Right. Yeah.
Sender.
And the privacy verdict is still out on Lightning. And there's a lot of,
right,
I think, FUD, but
there are
still unknown.
A lot of foot guns, especially if you're receiving on Lightning. There's a lot of ways you can fuck up.
Yeah. It's still unknown. And we're still waiting to see if somebody gets burned with Lightning. But then this is where the Chaumian mints come in.
Right.
So you have this spectrum of trade-offs. Right. And before we talk about that, you know, I'll say that the node developers, the core developers, for them, privacy means like nobody can untangle which node broadcast a transaction, and nobody can untangle the actual IP location of your node because it's on Tor, and like mempool behavior and rebroadcast behavior and all these
Dandelion
sorts of things to make the nodes themselves more private on the internet. Against Eclipse,
network level privacy,
network level against Eclipse attackers and things like that, which like that's looking forward to ultra sophisticated attackers, like someone saying, hey, we're going to Eclipse attack all the Bitcoin nodes in another country or something. Like that's the level of stuff they're thinking about. And so the Bitcoin node itself improves its own privacy with, you know, every release. They have little things that tweak privacy for the node itself, but it's a different type of privacy, right?
Right.
So there's all these different levels. But we're talking about, as you know, balance and history privacy. And
particularly in a post KYC world, particularly in a world where 99% of people are coming in providing full ID information and having their addresses tracked.
Right. And I think that it, you know, when you have layer one, layer two, and I think, you know, FediMint or something is layer 2.5, maybe layer 3. You have a menu of trade-offs, right? And so you trade off, you know, Lightning, you trade off locking up your funds for the instant settlement and having to be online, right? With the Chaumian Mint, you trade off custody and maybe inflation assurances, but you get pretty much perfect privacy. Right.
Among the
Anonset.
Like if you have 10 people in a Fediment or whatever.
Yeah. And interop with Lightning. So like, it's like, it's one of those 10 people that paid the Lightning invoice, but how can you connect those dots all the way through? Because you interface with the Chaumian, with the Mint nodes on Tor and all this sort of stuff. So I think. I think that a couple mints will get very large and the Anonset will be pretty big and it'll be.
And see, this is where
it's impossible.
Obi disagrees. So like, Fetamints is currently being led by Obi, Eric Sirion, and Justin Moon. And Obi disagrees with me on this. He thinks there's going to be a primarily small community Fetamints.
Right.
I agree with you that I think there'll be a couple really big ones, and then there'll be ideally hundreds, thousands of small ones that are all interoperable with each other.
Right.
But there's definitely a strong argument if they're competing on uptime and fees and potentially privacy, but a lot of people don't care about privacy, so maybe they're not really competing on the non-set as much. There's a kind of an economies of scale thing going on.
Right.
Right, where you want to go for the bigger, more reputable ones that have maybe lower fees.
Plus, think about like someone in a city where they don't really know any Bitcoiners, right?
Right.
Well, here comes some big mint run by a few NIMs. The NIMs are all, you know, mint members. And the random pleb says, hey, I'll just hook up to that one.
They've been running for 8 years. They have a great reputation, really good uptime.
Right. So maybe there's a transition. Maybe it starts big and maybe there's two or three big mints. Maybe it's just one huge one. And then like somehow it gets taken down. I don't know. And then that causes it. And then this is also like as the adoption of Bitcoin grows and grows and grows, maybe at some point you get to these community mints. Because you could imagine like a small village, a small little ecosystem with a two of three mint with three.
I mean, that's what Galois is basically doing, but without privacy.
Yeah.
Well, right now with the Bitcoin Beach wallet or whatever, it's two of three well-respected members, yeah. But there's no privacy from the custodians in that situation.
Right. So they should switch to a Chaumian mint.
This is what's so interesting is like, I've been getting, so my favorite thing in Bitcoin is just to get as many people to hate me as possible. So I've been getting a lot of shit from the privacy crowd on talking about federated Chaumian mints so often. Mm. And primarily is because of the custodial risk, which is reduced because it's federated, but still exists. There's right. still custodial risk.
Right.
And this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about dev culture and Bitcoin is that there's a lack of pragmatic tools. Like, okay, let's look at our situation right now. Let's see. And like you brought up Liquid earlier, I would say Federated Chaumian Mints to me is more, to most Bitcoiners, the better comparison rather than Liquid that nobody uses is Wallet of Satoshi, which is, you know, we can talk all day about how everyone should hold self-custody, but I've seen some hardcore Bitcoiners go down to El Salvador, and when they send their picture of them buying beer or whatever with Bitcoin, buying pupusas with Bitcoin, they're using Wallet of Satoshi. So the question is, okay, so how can we make a wallet that's as easy as Wallet of Satoshi, as cheap as Wallet of Satoshi, but gives you better privacy and has reduced custodial risk? So that's
right.
When I'm framing Fetamints, I kind of think it's more effective to talk about it from an improved custodial Lightning wallet point of view rather than an improved federation model.
And again, it's the trade-off.
It's a trade-off. Like really Bitcoiners will have a bunch of different options. They can go to KYC. They can go here. They can go there. They can hold self-custody. They can do self-custody with like a hosted multi-sig provider and have zero privacy.
And this is the Twitter effect, right? You make a tweet about something and someone says, you didn't provide all of your disclaimers, right. assumptions, and alternatives.
In 240 characters.
In this one tweet. Like, yes, of course there are trade-offs, but I didn't mention them, you know, because I'm talking about this one thing. And it, you know, and a lot of people have this sort of absolutist, like, we have to have the one solution to rule them all.
Right.
You know, oh, I don't like Lightning because of some either FUD or just certain thing about Lightning. I don't like that. So I'll just use main chain. Okay, fine. You use main chain, but Lightning's providing a lot of value for a lot of people. You know, Chaumian mints are still in dev, so we can't go out there and see what they're like in reality, but I think they're coming soon. And that'll be another set of trade-offs that, hey, if those people are using it and it works, great, right?
Yeah, classic disclosure, like this is not a actual working product yet. So we're just, right. It's like our space discussion. We're just theorizing and but I'm very hopeful. I think it'll be out soon and then we can actually have better discussions about it once we can actually play around with it. Clark, I mean, I appreciate your time. I know you have to hit the road. We're about 50 minutes in, but before we get to final thoughts here, I just wanted to say a little story about Clark. So Clark has been a very good internet friend for a long time. I would say a ride or die friend. Me and my lady during COVID, we left Brooklyn when they shut us down from everything. And we were doing Airbnbs all over the place. And we were, I would never disclose what our location was. We were doing Rabbit Hole Recap every week. But we were doing Airbnbs all over the place. And people knew we were doing Airbnbs all over the place. And we stayed at this really nice place in Maine, in Portland, for a week. And had this roof deck that I would work on every day. And I took a picture of my laptop and my coffee on the roof deck. And it was just a really great view, really great place to work. And I held it in my phone's gallery. I held it in my phone's gallery. And 3 weeks later, I posted it on Twitter. And I said, "Good morning, fam," or something like that with picture. And there was some clues there, but not many. And Clark was the only freak who messaged me that he decoded all of the clues. Like he looked at the skyline. He sent me a Google map, like direct coordinates of the roof I was sitting on when I took the picture. And he was like, "Dude, you need to take down this tweet." And I was like, "Ah, that was 3 weeks ago, but that's fucking awesome." You want to talk about that a little bit? Like, that was fucking ridiculous.
Right. So, yeah. So you said good morning. And I thought that you wouldn't have been there at the exact location. I thought you weren't, you know, giving away your location, but so you know, in the picture there's a river and there's some, you know, petrochemical tanks and some other roofline features. So I basically just got on Google and started looking. You said morning, so
you literally sent me a picture with the exact house, and then just the comment was bro. That was the
what are you doing what you doing. Yeah, so I just looked for rivers that were kind of heading in the right direction, and in the morning time, given the shadows, and you know, I kept going up the eastern seaboard until I found this one that seemed to match, and I kind of honed in on it. It took me about half an hour.
That's impressive. I asked him immediately. My first response was all caps, LMAO, well played. But I said, "How'd you figure that out?" He goes, "I hunted around on Google Maps for a river that ran northeast. Your pick had oil tanks in the background and a marina in the river, so that was the secondary clue." That was your explanation at the time. Also, our previous conversation there was about Skrit Cash.
Hey, Skrit Cash.
Adds up.
Yeah. Shout out Skrit.
But yeah, you were the only freak that figured it out. I was wondering if someone was going to... I didn't think someone was going to pinpoint it that hard, but I was wondering if someone was going to at least figure out Portland.
If someone lived there, they could have said, "Oh, hey, you know, I recognize that because that's where I live, but I guess... Need more freaks in Portland. Portland, Maine. We know you're out there."
It's a good city.
Yeah.
I've
never been to Maine.
Really beautiful. Maine is gorgeous. The politics worry me a little bit, but the Maine seacoast is absolutely gorgeous. And Portland's a really cool city. And also the politics kind of worry me a little bit, but we really enjoyed it in Portland. At least not, you know, like owning or renting there, just like staying there for a couple of weeks.
Right.
Anyway, Clark, it was a pleasure to have you on Dispatch. It's been a long time coming. It's a pleasure to have you in the new studio. I think you're guest number 6 or 7 in the new studio. We're going to have you put a sticker down and sign it with your name and your block height. Before we wrap up here, hit us with some final thoughts.
To all the Citadels out there, stay strong. Keep the walls fortified. Keep the zombie hordes out. We're all going to make it.
We're not all going to make it.
Except the people who aren't. The Bitcoiners are going to make it. When we write the history books, we're going to be savage to all the clown world that's going on right now. There'll be a chapter called Clown World, and we'll get to write it, and it'll be amazing.
True that. Winners do write the history books. Everyone should always remember that when they're reading history. Thank you, Clark. Thank you for joining. I hope your travels going forward from here are easy and pleasurable. Shout out to all the freaks who joined us in the live chat on this lazy Sunday afternoon. As I said in the previous rips, dispatch schedule will be more fluid going forward. They will be prioritizing in-person rips with people that are here at the studio because they're just fucking awesome. If you want to get notified of those, subscribe on Twitch, twitch.tv/civildispatch. I am bending the knee, and there will be a YouTube channel up as well, Citadel Dispatch dedicated YouTube channel, so you can subscribe there as well. And obviously the Twitter account and the Matrix chat. I always tell the ride or die freaks in the Matrix chat always know ahead of time if there's going to be a dispatch and what time it will be and who will be on it. So with all that said, thank you all for your support, especially those people that are sending via podcasting 2.0 apps, but also to anyone who's subscribing, leaving reviews and sharing with their friends and family. I love you all. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Stay humble and stack sats.